If you didn't pick up the stuff from last week, I bought a few more copies, the syllabus and project and stuff. So it's only one page for today. You didn't get it last week? Okay. That's the only sheet from today.
That wasn't the last week.
Okay. What? No, that's from last week, the materials. Were you here last week? Okay. That's the only sheet from today. That's from last week. If you got it last week, you don't need it. It's just last week's stuff. Did you get it? Okay. Yeah. That's last week's stuff. That's just last week's stuff. No, this is the only one, new one. That's just last week's stuff. Same thing as last week. Okay, folks, let's get settled in. I hope everybody's in a group already. Who's not in a group yet? Keep your hands up. Okay, who's not in a group yet? Here's what I'd suggest. After class, let the group list get together. I found sound almost biblical, right? And form some groups. I mean, I think that's the easiest way to do it. So after class, that's, I think, the best option. I did create the Google Shared spreadsheet, but I had to close it to just Stern students. So if you have a Stern email address, you should be able to get on. The reason I had to do that is otherwise, like, I got 1,000 requests from people who are not even in the class saying, can I be in a group? I said, you can be in a group if you want, but I'm not responsible for your groups. So it is so if you try to get into a group quickly, but even if you're not in a group, doesn't mean you can't pick a company, right? They're almost two separate issues. So pick a company as soon as you can, because for the first 4 weeks of this class, we have only one session each week, right? Last week was one session, this week is one session, next week is one session, the week after is one session. It's the strangest semester, as I said. So it's going to be easy to lose track of the class, and then all of a sudden it's going to hit you. So try to get started, pick a company, let's get moving. Okay? After this class, there'll be only one sheet you get or one handout you will get each session. That's a single page. Because as you can see, getting handouts physically to people is a nightmare when you have this big a class. So you're going to have one handout at the start of every class, and that'll usually include the start of the class test. So we're going to start today's class by building off what we left off with at the end of the last class. I talked about bias. That when you sit down to value a company, you're already biased. So what I'm going to start off with is a series of scenarios, and here's what I'd like from you. In each scenario, I'd like you to put yourself in the shoes of the person doing the valuation and tell me whether you're going to be biased up. You're going to bias the number up, whether that's going to push you. No. Whether you're going to be biased down. And if you can, tell me the mechanism you're going to use to make your bias come through. You know what I mean by mechanism? You're going to see it very quickly. Let's take the first example. You're valuing your own business. You're an entrepreneur. You've started a business. You have a startup business. You're valuing your business for either sale to a third person or a venture capital investment. Is your bias going to be to push the value up, push the value down, or you're not quite sure? What is it going to be? Up. Okay, so what are the mechanisms you're going to use as an entrepreneur to make your value larger? You're going to talk about big markets, right? Big potential market. You're going to talk about growth. If I ask you about costs, you say no costs at all. It's going to be effortless. And who can blame you? So you're going to project out big revenues. You're going to start making money really soon. You're going to come up with a high value. Now let's flip sides. Let's suppose you're the venture capitalist now looking at the same company. Is your bias up or down? Down. Why? What's the advantage you get if you value the potential business? You're valuing at a much smaller number. You get a higher percentage of the company, right? Because in a sense, as a venture capitalist, you invest in a company, what you get in return is, this is like Shark Tank, and you're the shark. And sharks are not nice fish. I actually don't know any sharks, so at least, you know, if you're a shark, you're going to go for the biggest percentage. So give me the mechanisms by which you're going to push the value down. So I'm the entrepreneur, I give you all these ambitions. How do you counter? First, you bring my revenue numbers down. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. Then you take this 3 years out or 4 years out because that's where we're negotiating. You come up with a number. You apply a multiple. The classic venture capitalist approach to valuation is not even worthy of the word method. Because here's what you do. You project an earnings out 3 years from now. You apply a multiple to that number. And then you discount that number at a made-up discount rate called a target rate of return. Think of how many mechanisms you have under your control as a venture capitalist, right? So first, when you project out earnings in year three, you project a lower number. When you apply a multiple to that number, you push for a lower multiple of that number. And here's your trump card. After you've come up with that number, if it looks too big, what do? You discount it back at a 60% rate of return that you just made up. It's not like there's some method to your madness. The higher numbers are good for you. And you end up with this really low value today and say, you know what, I want 125% of your company. Because that's kind of impossible, but basically you want the whole company. Now let's make this even more interesting. You're valuing a business you've run with your spouse for a long time, but you don't get along with that spouse anymore. So you're valuing it for divorce court. Half of whatever value attached to this company will go to your soon-to-be ex-spouse. So So what's the bias here? The value, low number, high number? You, high number, right? I hope you should have lots of spouses lined up ready to get married. You know? You want a low number, right? Have you been noticing that there's this trial going on in Texas with this guy called is his name? I don't know what his first name is. His last name is Ham. It's A-M-M. He's a big shale oil. He was worth billions at the peak of the oil boom. And he divorced his wife. And she, of course, wanted half the company. And this court case has been going on because this is what Ham's claiming, that the company's worth nothing, that he's an absolutely useless CEO, that he's never added any value to the company, that for half of nothing is nothing. And of course, he's not going to end up with nothing, but that's, you can see the objective is let's push the number down. And the mechanisms you're going to use are going to be the classic ones. You're going to lower your cash flows, reduce growth. You're going to use really low oil prices. If you're Ham valuing your company, saying oil prices are going to go to $15 a barrel and stay there, you're going to build into your valuation. And then after you're done with all of the valuation, you're going to apply all kinds of discounts to that number. Closely held company discount, private company discount, illiquidity discount, the objective being to push the number down. You're an appraiser for the owner of a business, valuing the business for tax purposes, state tax. So whatever value you get, I've got to pay 20% of that as taxes. What's your bias going to be? To come up with a low number. And if you're the IRS valuing the same business, your value is going to be high. It's almost laughable sometimes when you see these games being played out. And go, so why do you even waste your time going through this kabuki dance? Let's just end the process right now. Tell me what the numbers on this side. Let's split the difference right down the middle. You're a sell-side equity research analyst. Everybody familiar how equity research is structured? Sell-side analysts are the ones you read about every day. Work for the investment banks, you know. Buy-side analysts work for the mutual funds. You hardly ever hear about them because their recommendations go to the portfolio managers. So you're a sell-side analyst. You're valuing a company with the intent of putting a buy or a sell recommendation. Bias up, bias down. If you're an sell-side equity research analyst, who do you want to keep happiest? What are the different groups you got to keep happy? First, there's a company you track, right? Why do you want to keep them happy? Because otherwise, legally, they can't give you information anyway, the SEC. But, you know, you get little dribblets of stuff from them. Let's not call it information because that might be illegal. Yeah. But they put you up in a nice hotel when you show up at the Equity Research Analyst Conference. They treat you like a prince until you put a sell recommendation, at which point in time, God help you. So you got to, let's face it, you got to work with these companies for the rest of your life, 12 companies. So you want to keep the company, and they're going to be happier with a buy than a sell, right? The second group you have to keep happy are people within your own firm. Why should they care? Let's say your investment bank is the bank that's being used by the company on an IPO or in an acquisition, on a new capital offering, obviously. So you've got to keep them happy. But you also have a third group, which is the people who read your equity research report. Presumably, they hope to get some value from that report. So you've got the portfolio managers who read your equity research, and they're looking for something actually a little more substantive, right? They want you to put a sell if the stock is overpriced. To me, this is one of the most delicate dances in valuation. Okay. I think the tilt, and we know it from the output, is towards more buys than sells. And if you're going to put a sell out, you don't ever say the word sell. You say weak buy, or you put a numerical system. We've moved the stock from 7 to 5, which means get out of the stock right now. But we can't say the word SEL. I mean, that's not allowed, so we're going to send you messages otherwise. The tilt towards buys is understandable in sell-side equity research, given the fact that you have to maintain good relations with the company. But it's got to be tempered a little bit by the fact that your portfolio managers will start losing all faith in you if they believe you're not credible. You're an M&A analyst working for an investment bank for the acquirer. And there's a key here. So you work for the acquirer in a friendly takeover, valuing the target company. Is your bias up? Bias down? Are you uncertain? Depends on who you're trying to convince, right? In a sense, you got to convince the target company stockholders that they're getting a good deal. You also have to convince the acquiring company, in this case, your own company stockholders, that they're getting a good deal. And the output you have to deliver is actually different for the two, but you have an overwhelming desire to get the deal done. Right? Everything else is a side story. I think your bias is going to be to push up the value as much as you can and say, look, we're getting a great deal. We can pay this price. We can pay a 30% premium. So if you work for the acquiring company, you're going to push the value of the target company up to justify the premium of paying. So we got a great deal. And then they get somebody to sign a fair value opinion and move on. If you're the M&A analyst working for the investment banker for the target firm, what do you have to convince your stockholders? That they're getting a great deal as well? So this is one of those cases where everybody in the room wants the deal to go through. Nobody wants to tell the truth that the deal doesn't make sense if it doesn't make sense. So they actually have to push. So if you're the investment banker for the target firm, you've got to push the value down and say, look, they're overpaying. You're getting a great deal from the same transaction. And if I've actually had M&A deals where I've seen the same investment banker, this is actually very, very close to being unethical, be the investment banker on both sides of the deal. I have never understood. It must be two-faced in the true sense of the word, right? You've got to convince the acquiring company stockholders they're getting a good deal and the target company stockholders are getting a good deal. But if you're the target company investment bank, you've got to convince your stockholders, look, this is the best deal you're going to get. They're overpaying by 30%. But they share an overwhelming desire that the deal has to go through. If it's a hostile acquisition, then the game changes a little bit. If you're the investment banker for the acquirer in a hostile acquisition, you want the deal to go through, but you also want to keep your stockholders happy, right? So you got to have a high value for one group and a low value for the other. Again, I'm not sure how you pull this off, but maybe the way you do this is you talk about synergy premiums, because you say only if this merger goes through will there be synergy premiums. So that keeps the acquiring company stockholders happy, and then you show them the lower value without the synergy premium to the target company stockholders, saying you'd never get a price like this from anybody else. And if you're the target company's stockholders, what do you want? This is one of the few cases where the guy does not want the deal to go through, right? Because if you're the banker for the target company in a hostile acquisition, the very fact that it's hostile means you've got to fight off the acquisition. There, it's pretty clear that you want to show people, this is too low a price. Look, your value is much, much higher. Again, you can see the contortions that people have to go through because their motives have been soiled by who pays them. Let's finish the process out. You're a buy-side analyst valuing a company for your portfolio. So if you work for Fidelity, you're hired as an analyst. You're a buy-side analyst. So you value companies for portfolio managers. Let's say you're valuing a company. Let's give the company a name. You're valuing Apple for your portfolio manager. And your portfolio manager owns a lot of this company already. Let that color your conclusion. If you show this portfolio manager the stock is overpriced, you're telling him the truth, right? But who wants to hear the truth? I mean, you're a portfolio manager, you own a large amount of stock. What do you want? You want confirmation that you did the right thing? And if the portfolio manager shorted the shares, he wants to hear exactly what will confirm what he's already done or she's already done. In every one of these cases, you can see how bias determines what the end number is going to be. When I look at a valuation, I ask two questions. Who did this valuation? Who paid them to do this valuation? You answer those two questions, the rest of the valuation kind of falls into place, because once you've established the motives of the people doing the valuation, who's paid them to do the valuation, you don't have to dig through the details to discover which direction the valuation is going to be tilted. So the first and biggest problem in valuation, and to me, the most overwhelming problem, is the problem of bias. And you tell me who pays you to do evaluation and how much you get paid. I'll tell you which direction the bias is and how much the bias is. And I'll give you a story to back into how much bias affects valuations. This was about 20 years ago. So we're in the intro packet that you got last session. So this is about 20 years ago, a company called Lynn Cable. So it's a cable company. And AT&T had this option to buy 49% of Lynn Cable at an appraised value. So that's the way the option is actually written. So time for the option to be exercised comes about. AT&T goes out and hires Morgan Stanley to value Lynn Cable so they can buy the 49%. So you guys are going to be Morgan Stanley. You're working for AT&T, the potential, the buyer. And you have to value the 49% of Lynn Cable so AT&T can buy it. So you get to work valuing the company. Lynn Cable goes out and hires Lehman Brothers. I'm sorry to do this to you, but think of yourselves as pre-bankrupt Lehman Brothers. And you're doing the same thing that Morgan Stanley is doing, valuing the same 49%, but you're working for the seller. So Morgan Stanley works for the buyer, Lehman Brothers works for the seller, two investment banking teams go to work. Valuing the same company at the same point in time with the same financials and the same information. One investment bank comes back with $105 per share. The other comes back with $155 per share. I'm going to let you guess which side came back with which number. Who do you think came back with $105 per share? Morgan Stanley. And why? Because you work for the buyer. You have to come in with a lowball number. You came back with a 155 because you work for the seller and you have to come up with a highball. You did your jobs. In fact, the difference was so large, they decided to call in a third investment banker. Why settle for two fees when you can have three, I guess? And they call in Wasserstein Perella. You heard of these guys? I'm going to say something incredibly harsh about these guys, but I mean every word of it. These guys couldn't value a $20 bill in a brown paper bag if you put it in front of them. Single-handedly, this outfit brought down the practice evaluation about six notches just by itself. They'd have invented some multiple. Enterprise value to cash in the bag, 3.3. Next thing you know, you'd be paying $66 for a $20 bill. But if you're Wasserstein Perella, you're right in the middle here, right? You don't want to piss off either side too much. 105, 155. Where's the safest place for you to be? 130, right? They came back with $127.50. I'm going to let you in on a little secret in valuation, but don't let it out of this room. If you're ever asked to value something, no matter what it is, never ever come back with a nice round number. Ever. Don't tell me the target price is $40. Tell me it's $38.87. It's amazing what that second decimal point will do in terms of creating an illusion that you actually know what you're doing. When in doubt, add decimals. The intimidation factor is overwhelming. In Excel, you can keep going. You can make the entire page one column with 50 decimals. But if you flip it around to the other side, when you see a lot of decimals, you know what? You should get really suspicious because people are trying to hide something behind those decimals. In most valuations, the value gets set first, the valuation follows. The more biased a process is, the less point there is to even doing valuation. And you know what the most biased process of all is? The M&A process. I've wondered why we even have M&A bankers. Why do we do valuation M&A? You know what the value of a target company is? It's whatever you've chosen to pay for it plus $10. Why do we go through the charade of actually valuing these companies and coming to the same conclusion? You say, but what about that fair value opinion? It's not worth the paper it's written on. The only people who think it's worth something are lawyers. I know there are a few lawyers in the room. It's keep lawyers and appraisers in work. No, that's basically what it does. It gives them work to do. They can charge fees. It doesn't. The worst deals in history have had a fair value backing them up, right? Time Warner, AOL. There's a fair value backing that up. It's a good deal for you. The process is so biased because of the way it's set up. You're an M&A banker. I'm an acquirer. I come to you with a question. Should I do this deal? What are the two possible answers you can give me? Yes or no? Let's play it out. If you say no, what do you get out of this? The undying gratitude of my stockholders, but try paying bonuses with that. Or you can say yes, in which case you make $100 million. Then we wonder why we get bad valuation advice. Asking a deal maker whether a deal makes sense is like asking a plastic surgeon whether there's something wrong with your face, right? What's the answer you're going to get? You're perfect already? So your cheeks look too big, your lips look too thin. I mean, at the end of the process, he's got to find something or she's got to find something wrong with your face to make money. The process is too biased. Unless you remove the bias from the process and reduce it, there is no point. The head of M&A at an investment bank called me about a year ago. And she said, "No, can you come in and talk to my M&A bankers about valuation?" I said, "Why should we waste our time?" She said, "What do you mean? They're smart bankers." I said, "It's nothing to do with the intelligence of your bankers. Your process is too screwed up." Nothing. This, I mean, her, what she thought was, if we teach these people better valuation practices, our valuations will get better. That's not the problem here. The problem is you've set up a process where the destination is driving the valuation. The deal making is driving the valuation. And who can blame them? It's not the banker's fault. It's the process's fault. So later when we talk about acquisition valuation, this is one of those things we're going to come back to, is how do we reduce the bias? We can't make it go away. How do we at least reduce the bias so we can get fairer estimates of value out of this process? And the first thing we need to do is separate the deal making from the deal analysis. You cannot have the deal makers tell you whether a deal makes sense. It's bias 101. Let's move on to the second big misconception about valuation. If I do a good valuation, I'm going to get the right answer. We talked a little bit about this in the last session, about people who think that valuation is a science. You know when this process gets started? Very early in life. Around the age of 5, you go off to school. Teacher comes and puts a sheet of paper in front of you, 2 plus 2. You write 4. Got the right answer, you did everything right. You get any other answer, the reaction is, you got the wrong answer, you must have done something wrong. And this gets drummed into you all the way through school. If you do things right, you get the right answer. If you got the wrong answer, you must have done something wrong. And then you go off to college, and God help you, if you go down one of those quant paths. Any engineers here recovering? No? So you get 4 or 5 more years. If you do things right, you get the right answer. Input, output. And then you end up in this class. Evaluation class. You all picked a company to value, right? Every semester I've taught this class. Like clockwork, around the 11th or 12th week, I can predict what's going to happen. A few people from the class, mostly engineers, would show up in my office. They'll come in and put a valuation down on my desk. "So I'm done with the evaluation. Could you take a look and tell me whether I got the right answer?" I don't even look at the evaluation. I push it across the table back at them and say, "I don't know what the right answer is." And you can see their faith in the system start to crack. So you're teaching this class. You don't know the value of a company? So if I knew the value of every company, why would I be teaching this class? All of Hawaii would be mine. Okay? Forget about Larry Ellison buying one little island. I'd buy the whole state. But at this stage, you can see the group splintering. One half of the group cannot handle the fact that there is no right answer. Do you know what happens to them? They become fixed income people. Let's face it. It's a lot more comforting sitting there with a bond, right? The maturity is given, the coupon is given. All you have to worry a little bit about is the default risk. And if it truly makes you uncomfortable not knowing what the right answer is, stay in the bond market. There's a place for you. But the other half says, this is kind of fun. If you don't know what the right answer is, I can never, ever conclusively be wrong. That's one of the great things about equities. You can never, ever conclusively be wrong. You pick a stock, you ask me to buy it, it goes down 28 years in a row. You know what you tell me? Not a long enough time horizon. Stock goes bankrupt, the system got in the way, right? I think it's great not having a right answer, but psychologically, you got to be okay with it. Because In valuation, you can do everything right and you can get the wrong answer. In fact, it's not even can. You will get the wrong answer. But here's one of the great ironies in valuation. The more uncertain you feel about your valuation, the greater the payoff to doing valuation. Let me explain what I mean by this. I give you two companies to value, Procter & Gamble and Twitter. Which one's going to be easier to value? Procter & Gamble, we know what it does. It's got a business model, it's got financials, it's got a history, I can use all kinds of stuff. You can value Procter & Gamble more precisely than you can value Twitter. That's true for every person in this class. But then ask yourself a follow-up question. Don't ask yourself, how precise is my valuation of Procter & Gamble relative to my valuation of Twitter? Ask yourself, how precise is my valuation of Procter & Gamble relative to somebody else valuing Procter & Gamble? That's where the payoff to valuation is greatest, right? Is when you're most uncertain, is when your valuation is more precise than everybody else's. Which means your payoff to doing valuation is greater when you value Twitter than when you value Procter & Gamble, because most people are not even trying. You're going to hear these words over and over again in this class. Go where it's darkest. When you pick companies to value, go where it's darkest. That's where the payoff to valuation is greatest, because most people are not even trying. Uncertainty scares people. It's human nature. Just like bias drives valuations off the tracks, uncertainty drives valuations off the tracks, because we look for coping mechanisms with uncertainty. And those coping mechanisms include denial. What uncertainty? I don't see any. No, autopilot. You know, we try to figure out all kinds of ways of dealing with uncertainty that are not healthy. Hopefully, in the process of looking at uncertainty, we can look at healthy ways in which we can incorporate uncertainty into valuations. Which brings me to my third and biggest misconception, or third misconception about valuation, which is if I make my model bigger, it's going to get better. And it's so easy to build big models now, right? You start with an Excel spreadsheet, you can start adding inputs, you can put macros on top of macros. Inputs come in, they never leave. Your model starts with 15 inputs and it has 25, 30. And God help you if there's a team in the basement of your company building valuation models for you. You know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about the Geek Squad, which is you hire these software people who write models, who love writing models, you send them to the basement. I don't know why. I guess they can't see the light of day. They become vampires or werewolves or whatever. And they love building models. The model gets bigger and bigger and bigger. By the time they're done, the model has 85 inputs to value one company. And they send that model up to your desk saying, from this day on, when you value a company, use our in-house model. Two things happen to these models. One is what I call input fatigue. You know what input fatigue is? I'll describe it. Some of you work during the summer and at work long hours, probably will very quickly recognize this symptom. It's usually around 11 o'clock on a Saturday night when it'll hit you. You think you're done for the week, finally. You get ready to shut things down, go home. Your managing director, your boss, comes in and throws a 10K on your desk. Doesn't put it down, throws it on your desk. I want this company valued first thing tomorrow morning. Why? Sunday morning. It's his trial by fire. He wants to see how much you really want this job. Now, part of you wants to exercise your option to abandon. I won't describe this. It's a deeply satisfying option to exercise. It usually takes the form of you picking up the 10K, throwing it back in your managing director's face, and you do it yourself. That's a deeply satisfying moment. But it's followed by some deeply dissatisfying consequences, like not having a job. So you think about it. Then you remember the rent and the car payments and all the rest and say, okay, I'll value the company. With your in-house model, so you sit down with the in-house model, 85 inputs, right? You start entering the inputs very carefully. You get to the 15th input, the clock strikes midnight. You're not Cinderella. You wish you were. Where's my pumpkin? Let me get home. Hey? Then you look down, there are 70 more inputs to go. Your stomach drops. Look at the 16th input. It says, what was the inventory 5 years ago? Part of you wants to go look it up, but that part's too exhausted to get out of the chair. The other part says, enter a random number. Let's move on. And it's amazing how quickly the random numbers roll on, right? And before you know it, you've done 70 random numbers, 15 numbers you thought about. The scary thing is when the output comes out, it all looks the same. that input you toiled hours over, random numbers all start to swim together. And here's another little secret in valuation. You're valuing a company with a lot of random number inputs. You know what you should do? Create more detail in your output. Have 500 line items. Nobody will have any idea what's random and what's not. When somebody sends me a valuation or comes in with a valuation, the first thing I do? I pick it up. If I can't pick it up, it's usually because a valuation runs 500 pages. My next question is, what are you trying to hide from me? Good valuations should be parsimonious. The physical sciences, there's this rule of parsimony. Basically, it says when you're trying to explain a phenomenon, start with the simplest possible explanation before you make yourself Einstein. In valuation, we should have a similar principle. When you're trying to value something, start with the simplest model you can get away with, the fewest inputs you can get away with before you start adding more. If you can value a company with 3 inputs, don't go looking for 5. If you can value a company with 1 year of forecast, don't do 10. You think, what's the harm? The harm is you have to forecast those numbers and you're bringing in inputs you don't have to bring in. Less is more. That doesn't mean you can't have complexity in your model, but the complexity you should build in should be complexity you chose to build in. So this is something you're going to run into, not only in this class, but if you do valuation for a living, is how much detail should I add? And the answer is very simple. Don't add any more detail than you absolutely have to. I'll give you an example. In valuation, one of the line items that you often need to get to cash flows is change in working capital. But if you look at accounting statements, change in working capital is broken down into 6, 7, 8 different line items, right? Accounts receivable, accounts payable, supplier credit. I have never in my life ever broken working capital down into its ingredients. And there's a very simple reason. Maybe you can forecast days of accounts receivable in the year 2030. And if you can, all the more power to you. I have no idea. So what's the point of breaking things down into more detail if I'm bringing no information into the process? So when you look at detail, that's a question you should be focusing on. So that's the first thing that happens is you get input fatigue. The second is the model becomes a black box. Know what I mean by black box? After a while, you're not sure who's running whom. Are you running the model? Is the model running you? Feels like the model is asking you for numbers. Go get me that number. Go get me this number, right? And then says, go get me a cup of coffee. And you come back, the model's left. I still remember reading an equity research report that a J.P. Morgan analyst had put out on a company. A company I was fairly familiar with, and he had a target price of 85. The stock was trading at 35. So I was curious, why did he come up with this high number? So I called him. He said, why do you think this company is worth so much? He said, I didn't do it. I said, what do you mean? Your name's in the report, it says $85. He said, I didn't do it. So who did it? He said, ValueMac did it. I said, who the heck is ValueMac? He said, that's our in-house valuation model. So what did it do? Sneak into your office in the middle of the night, value the company, and leave it on your desk? But you know what he was trying to tell me, right? We have this incredibly complex model. I fed numbers into the model. Something happened inside the model. A number popped out on the other side. It's amazing how many people value companies using models where things happen inside the model and they don't even realize what's happening. Most of you know that I have spreadsheets that basically give you the template for valuing companies. And there will be a few of you will email me saying, am I allowed to use your spreadsheet to value a company? Absolutely, on one condition. Here's what I don't want to see in your final report. Here are the words. The De Morgan model valued the company at. Then all bets are off. Because you know what you're trying to do, right? You're saying, you did it. Your spreadsheet did it. It's not my fault. If you use my spreadsheet, take ownership of it. There are no macros in it. There are no hidden cells, no protected cells. You can go in and mess it, whatever you want to mess up. I'll give you enough rope to hang yourself because hopefully in the course of the class, you will not hang yourself. But make it your spreadsheet. Make it your model. And you can mangle some really simple assets using complex models. What's the simplest asset in a company's balance sheet to value? If I gave you Google to value right now, of all of the assets you see on its balance sheet, what should be the simplest one to value? Cash, right? You might not believe this, but every week I get at least two or three, maybe more emails from people I don't know. I get lots of emails from people I don't know, but these are very specific. Claiming to have built a better model to value cash. They want me to look over the model. So here's how the emails will go. Professor Deodorant. It's amazing what Microsoft Word spell check does to my name. I actually tried this out. Type in deodorant, turn on spell check, it turns into deodorant. I'm not, see, at least I smell good. So okay, you know, it could be a lot worse, right? I've spent the last 6 months of my life building this model to value cash, which my response is, what an empty life you must have. Then at the bottom of the spreadsheet, there'll be this little attached spreadsheet, cashvaluation.xls. Can you take a look at it? I've actually programmed the F7 key on my laptop to respond to these emails. I hit it. Do you know what it says? Have you tried counting it? Works with cash, 20, 40, 60, 80. Now it's going to take you a long time to count 70 billion, which is what Google has, but counting cash works reasonably well. What the heck are you doing building a model to value cash? Because here's what I predict will happen. Google has about 70 billion in cash. You build a model to value cash, here's what you're going to do. You're going to project the income you're going to earn on the cash. Right now, what rate do you think Google's making on that cash? To be called cash, it's got to be liquid and close to riskless, right? So if you're lucky, maybe 0.2%, 0.3%. So what you do is you take 70 billion, you project out income at 0.2% for the next 10 years. And once you project income, all is lost because then the Pavlovian response kicks in. This is a response you go to business school to acquire, which is when you project numbers out for the next 10 years, what are you trained to do next? Discount them, present value, time value of money. And to discount them, what do you need? You need a discount rate. You pull out your corporate finance book, your valuation book, betas, CAPM, risk premium, cost of equity, cost of capital. That MBA is really paying off now. You get to a 10% cost of capital for Google, and then you start discounting the income you just projected on the cash back at 10%. Let's see where we are. You have $70 billion invested risklessly, making 0.2% a year. You're discounting that income back at a 10% cost of capital. What's going to happen to the $70 billion? It's going to become $55 billion. Magically, you've just wiped out $15 billion in cash. You want to show me cash is worthless? Use a 30% cost of capital. You'll be wiping out cash right and left. Trillions of dollars of cash will disappear. You think that's absurd. I would never do something that stupid. Don't put it past yourself. I mean, you start with net income to estimate cash flows. You're dead in the water already. You know why? Because net income includes both income from operating assets and income from cash. So if you have a cash flow based on net income, you've just mixed together safe cash flows with risky cash flows and you discount them back at a risk-adjusted discount rate, you've just discounted cash for no reason at all. So don't go looking for trouble. So I call this the Bermuda Triangle evaluation. Part of the Bermuda Triangle, this is that mythical place in the Atlantic where ships and boats and planes disappear. Supposedly. The Bermuda Triangle evaluation is where good sense disappears. And the three sides of the triangle are what we talked about, bias, uncertainty, and complexity. We can talk about the mechanics of valuation as we will in this class, but remember, when you make big mistakes in valuation, they're going to come from one of these three places. And we're going to come back to these three issues over and over again in the process of valuation, not because they're side issues, but because they're central to why valuations sometimes go bad. So let's set the table. As I said, there are three basic approaches to valuation, and there are only three. So you can come up with others, and I'll put them into these three buckets. The first approach to valuation is intrinsic valuation. As I said, more than half of this class we're going to spend on intrinsic valuation. What's intrinsic valuation? You value an asset based on its cash flows, its growth, its risk. Discounted cash flow valuation might be the tool that we use for intrinsic valuation, but it's only one of several tools you can use to estimate intrinsic value. Relative valuation is when you value something given how similar assets are being priced out there, which is pricing. And as I said, this is component of valuation where option pricing can help you. Valuing a biotechnology company, an oil reserve, you know, oil company, a commodity company. So those are the three approaches to valuation. I at least want to give you the big picture of each of these approaches. Behind all of these approaches is an assumption. An assumption that markets make mistakes and that we can exploit those mistakes. That assumption is often implicit, but I'm going to try to make it explicit. With each approach, I'm going to say, this is what you're assuming about markets. This is how you think markets make mistakes. And this is how you can make money off those mistakes. So whether you like it or not, when you use a valuation approach, you're telling me something about what you believe about markets. What I hope that you will get out of this class is your own belief system about markets. Not my belief system, but your own. Because I'm not going to impose what I think about markets on you because it's not going to work. It's not because I'm not going to try, but it's not going to work. You have to come up with your own belief system about markets because implicit in all these approaches is the assumption that markets make mistakes. So let's take each of these approaches, look at what drives philosophically each approach, what the pluses and minuses are, very generally, of each approach, and what kinds of investors this approach is going to work for best. So let's start with discounted cash flow valuation. Very simply put, the discounted cash flow value of an asset is the present value of the expected cash flows on it. It's that first class we all get in finance, right? Project the cash flows, you have a discount rate, you get a present value. That's the basis for discounted cash flow valuation. And when you use a discounted cash flow valuation approach, philosophically, here's what you're trying to do. You're trying to estimate the intrinsic value of an asset, of a company. I liken this to the search for the Holy Grail. You know, for centuries, people have been looking for the Holy Grail, right? You've seen the Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, the whole expeditions go off and such. How many people have found it? None that we know of, but we keep looking. Because once we find it, it's going to be amazing. Intrinsic valuation is a little bit like that because in intrinsic valuation, you never get to see the intrinsic value. Nobody knows what it is, but we keep trying. We keep the faith in intrinsic valuation. We assume that by using these discounted cash flow models, we're getting a glimpse of the promised land. And if you break down a discounted cash flow model down, no matter how complicated it is, there are three ingredients that you will see. You'll see expected cash flows, you'll see a discount rate, and you'll see a life for the asset. You can make a discounted cash flow model as complicated as you want, but those are the three end products. But let's get down to brass tacks here. This is all about making money, right? So let's look at the assumptions you need to make to actually make money of intrinsic valuation. First, you have to assume that markets make mistakes, right? We talked about the pricing process in the last session, that markets make mistakes. Easy assumption to make. Even the firmest believer in efficient markets will concede to you, markets make some really big mistakes. Second, you have to assume you can find those mistakes with your metrics and models. Now we're on dangerous ground because the track record of people who claim to find market mistakes is not that good. Whether it's portfolio managers or hedge funds, collectively they actually underperform the market. But let's say you're the special one. You have a metric or model that actually works and you found a market mistake. Let's give the market mistake a name. Let's call it Cisco. Let's assume that you value Cisco at 45, the stock is trading at 25. Let's say you're right, it should really be trading at 45. You go out and you buy a million shares of Cisco at 25. Have you made any money yet? What's the third assumption you need to make to actually make money on your valuations? The market has to correct its mistakes. And that's the wild card, right? Because you say, how do I get the market to correct its mistakes? My honest answer is, you can't. You can get on Yahoo message board and say, Cisco is cheap, Cisco is cheap, Cisco is cheap, Cisco is... But nobody's listening to you. There's a subset of investors who might be able to do something to move the price, but you and I are not in that subset. At least I'm not. I don't want to insult you if you're in that subset. But you can be right, and you can go bankrupt being right. The only consolation prize I can offer you is if you're right, The longer your time horizon, the greater the chances that the market will correct its mistakes. Even though I can't guarantee it, but if you have a longer time horizon and you were right in the first place, the greater the chances you will be able to make money off your mistakes. So what do you need to be a good candidate to use discounted cash flow valuations? You need to have a reasonably good approach to valuing businesses, right? Doesn't have to be a discounted cash flow valuation, could be something else. You need to be able to find market mistakes, and you need to have a long enough time horizon that you can wait for those mistakes to be correct. I'm going to argue that probably 90% of the numbers you see out there come out of relative valuation of pricing. And relatively few people use intrinsic valuation. You see why? If you're a portfolio manager, you could be a firm believer in intrinsic valuation, but what's your time horizon? Wrong question, right? It's not what your time horizon, it's what your client's time horizon. And if your clients have 6-month time horizons, I don't care how long-term your time horizon is, you are constrained by that, and you're not a good candidate for intrinsic valuation, even if you can do it well and you believe in it. So if you look at the advantages of discounted cash flow valuation, a lot of people who like to talk the value investing talk, if you truly believe that when you invest in a stock, you're buying a piece of a business, not a security. You're buying a piece of a business. That's the old Warren Buffett saying. Don't think of buying a stock in a company. Think of buying a piece of a business. Then intrinsic valuation reflects that choice, right? Because you're trying to value it as a business. You're not saying, what will other people pay for it? You're saying, what would I pay for this piece of the business? And to the extent that it forces you to understand the business, you're going to get a much deeper assessment of what makes a business as valuable as it is. And if you've made your choices right, if you've estimated the cash flows, it doesn't matter what the rest of the market thinks because the cash flows are going to make up for whatever you paid for the stock. So the advantage of discounted cash flow valuation is you've kind of immunized yourself from market mood and market momentum. You're basically making your investment choices based on what an asset will deliver. So you're listening to Ben Graham, security analysis, that tradition that goes back 100 years of investing in something based on what it's worth. But there are some disadvantages. Here's the first one. Okay? Because you're trying to value a business, you will need to do more work to assess that value than if you had priced the business. You're going to see this when you start to value a business with an intrinsic valuation model and a relative valuation model, is you're going to see you have to make more assumptions, more inputs. And the assumptions have to be explicit. You can't just say high growth. You've got to come up with a number. And because you're making these estimates, you have to be okay being wrong on those numbers. Because you are going to be wrong. You're trying to forecast the future. And here's the bigger problem if you're a portfolio manager. Let's say you run an equity mutual fund. What's your mission? I send you money, and you're supposed to invest in equities. It's not to ask questions. Are stocks collectively undervalued? That's not your job. Your job is to find stocks for me to buy today, given where the market is. Your mission is a relative valuation mission, not an intrinsic valuation mission. If you take my money and you leave it sitting in cash, saying, I can't find anything to buy, you're going to be fired by Fidelity, and then I'm going to get really pissed off at you because I sent the money for you to invest in stocks. Your job is a relative valuation job. So next time you jump on a portfolio man and say, how come you're not more like Warren Buffett? Think about what you're asking that guy to do. You're trying to ask him to do something that's not his job or her job. So think about that when you think about why people are so attached to multiples and comparables. Their job requires them to make relative valuation judgments. And in fact, when you think about an equity research analyst putting a buy recommendation on a stock, remember I said most sell-side analysts track about 15 companies. So when you see a buy, what's he saying? Given the 15 companies I was asked to look at, this is the cheapest company, right? So if he's following the social media sector, the dot-com sector in 99, his job is not to tell you the entire sector is overvalued. His job is to tell you, of these social media stocks, Facebook looks like a bargain. Don't blame him for doing his job. You don't have to listen to the buy because you might have a different mission. You might not have to invest in social media, but discounted cash flow valuation might not be the tool for you if your job is to make relative valuation judgments. So this, if you think about who's the best candidate for discounted cash flow valuation, discounted cash flow valuation is best suited for investors with very long time horizons. What's allowed Warren Buffett to have a really long time horizon? Whose money is he investing? He's investing insurance capital. And the nice thing about insurance capital is it comes with actuarial tables. It's not like investment capital, with insurance, the capital that comes in insurance companies, it doesn't get panicked and say, we're all going to die tomorrow, send me the money now. He has that advantage of having a predictable time horizon. It works best for investors with long time horizons. So it works for Warren Buffett. You know who else it works for? Each and every one of us on our own money. Why? Because the only person you have to answer to right now is probably yourself. Be kind to yourself. And if you get married, my suggestion is you can go into your online brokerage account and make your statements paperless. Good idea. I did it about 6 years ago. This way my wife never gets to see what's in our portfolio. So she has no idea that we bought a stock 5 years ago that's been going down every single year. But it's a point I try to make. It's one advantage you and I have over the largest portfolio manager in the world. We're answering to one client, ourselves, and we can have long-time horizons if we choose to have those long-time horizons. But here's the added bonus, if you can bring it to play. What did I say the third leg was? You have to get the market to correct its mistakes, right? And I said for most of us, that's going to be difficult to do or impossible to do. But what if you're Carl Icahn? What does he do right after he buys a stock? He doesn't go hide in a corner. He's on CNBC. He's on Bloomberg. He's like, he stops and I think he's on Times Square, 42nd Street at the corner. He's like, buy. So he's everywhere, right? And you can see what his agenda is. Essentially, he says, I just bought the company. I want to get you to buy the company and push the price up. So if you're Bill Ackman buying Procter & Gamble or Mondelez, you get a bonus, which is the minute you do it, the Wall Street Journal picks up the news that you bought it. Other people then go and buy it. And in the process, they push the price up towards a value. And you act as your own catalyst. That's what activist investors have as an advantage that the rest of us might not have, that allows some of them, not all of them, some of them, to actually invest based on intrinsic value. So discounted cash flow valuation, that's the big picture. Let's talk about relative valuation. Relative valuation, you value an asset based on how similar assets are priced out there. So it's really pricing, not valuation. And philosophically, you've given up on this notion of intrinsic value. You say, I don't care to know what value is. I don't care what value is. I'm just going to price the asset. And we break down a pricing. Here are the three pieces you will see. First, you will see a standardized price. What I mean by a standardized price is you'll see a P/E ratio, price to book, EV to EBITDA, multiple is a standardized price. You'll see comparables. Other assets you claim are just like yours. And then you'll see a story. Every relative valuation, that's basically how it's constructed. And in relative valuation, here's what you're assuming about markets. In intrinsic valuation, I assume that markets make mistakes and correct them over time, right? In relative valuation, I assume that markets are right on average, but that they're wrong across companies. It's a very different view on market mistakes, but you assume that those cross-sectional mistakes disappear over time. So we're two different views on how markets work. And the advantage of relative valuation is it is simpler to do in one sense because it is you are working with fewer inputs. But that can be deceptive, as you're going to see later in this class, is even though you make fewer assumptions when you use P/E ratios, or price to book, or EV to EBITDA, you're making a lot of implicit assumptions. Let me explain. If you tell me that your stock is cheap because it trades at a P/E of 12 and the average for the sector is 15, you know what you're implicitly assuming? That the growth in your stock is similar to the growth in the sector. The risk in your stock is similar. You don't state those assumptions. They're implicit rather than explicit. But fewer explicit assumptions. You're also much more in sync with the market when you do pricing, right? Why? Because everything is scaled to the market. You're never going to tell me all social media companies are expensive. Why? Because you're comparing them to each other. Something's got to be cheap. It might be 80 times revenues, but 80 times revenues is cheap if everything else trades at 150 times revenues. So you're going to be always able to find a buy recommendation if you're an equity research analyst, to buy stocks if you're a portfolio manager. And finally, in relative valuation, the game you're playing changes. It's not about being right about overall value. It's being right about the next incremental information you get about the company. Sounds fancy, right? What's the most biggest source of incremental information in a company? Happens 4 times a year. Around every earnings report, you become a master at playing the earnings report game. Will the earnings be greater than expected or less than expected? Because it's a pricing game. You really don't care about value. You care about changes in price, right? That's how you make money. It's a different game. So I don't blame you if you're a portfolio manager who prices stocks, if you get really obsessed about earnings dates and earnings reports and expected earnings and what the earnings will be. And small earnings mistakes translate into large amounts of money for you in either direction. It's exactly the way the pricing game is played. So the advantage of relative valuation is it might match up better to what your job is as a portfolio manager or an equity research analyst or as an investor. The disadvantage is the flip side of the advantage, which is you're in sync with the market. But if the market is completely screwed up, you're in sync with a screwed up number, right? So if all social media stocks are expensive, the fact that you bought the cheapest of them is not going to make you money. It's just going to mean that you lose less money than everybody else. Small consolation. So when you play the pricing game, you have no anchor, no sense of what the value of something is. And that doesn't make you a bad person. It just means that you're going to be much more reactive in what you do because you're making a judgment about what things are relative to each other. So I'm not saying intrinsic valuation is good and relative valuation bad. Two different games. And as I said, what I'd like you to think about is which game fits you better. And if you are thinking about a job already, think about what that job will require to do because the tools you have to bring to that job might be different depending on whether your job is going to be a valuation job or a pricing job. Because if it's a pricing job, what you have to master is relative valuation. And as I said, you make lots of implicit assumptions in relative valuation. When you say, buy the stock because it trades at 6x EBITDA, whether you like it or not, you're telling me something about the return on capital in the company, the reinvestment in the company. And one of the things I'm going to try to do during this class is make those implicit assumptions explicit. So when you say you're going to pay 22 times earnings, I'm going to turn around and say, are you okay with the 25% growth rate? So I never mentioned that. You might not have, but when you said you're going to pay 22 times earnings, implicit in that number are expectations about growth and risk, and it's my job to make them explicit for you and say, are you okay with this? And if you think about the kinds of investors or the kinds of assets where relative valuation is going to work best, it works best if you have lots of comparable assets, right? That's why it works so well if you're talking about real estate. You know where else it works? Let's say you want to buy tickets to opening day. The Giants or the Jets home this weekend. I don't know, whoever's home. You decide to go to NFL opening day. You go to SeatGeek. You ever gone to SeatGeek? This is a site that aggregates StubHub and Ticket City and all those little sites where you can buy. But the nice thing about SeatGeek is they show you the stadium. They'll also break down all of the tickets for sale into great deals, good deals. In fact, awesome deals is the very top. Awesome, then great, good, bad, horrible. You're saying, how do they come up with that? It's magic. You know how they come up with that classification? They take each section of the stadium. They have all the seats that people have available for sale in that section. Section 212. Let's say there are 20 seats for sale. They rank them in terms of price. And they look at which ones are really low. And so those are the awesome deals. They're doing relative value. And it works really well. Because it's the same game. It's the same section, maybe even the same row. How much closer can you get to getting something truly comparable? So it works best when you have assets, we have lots of comparable. It tends to start to break down when assets are unique. If I ask you to price a Picasso, all you have to do is find 100 other Picassos that have sold in the last month. Well, good luck to you on that one. One Picasso might sell once every 5 years. You're saying, well, maybe I can use a Chagall or something. But you can't compare as easily. It's more unique. And you know what? There are some companies that are closer to Picasso's than they're to SeatGeek, right? If I ask you to price Apple, what do you compare it to? What business is it in? It's not in the computer business. It's not in the entertainment business. It's not the smartphone business. You can already see that relative valuation is going to be easier in some segments of the market than in others, and for some investors than others. You know what types of investors can use relative valuation the easiest? What do we say we bet on relative valuation? The market overall is right, but that individual stocks are mispriced, right? Some are overpriced and underpriced, and you make money how? When they move to their correct pricing. Now, if you're a long-only investor, which is what most mutual funds are, then you play a one-sided game. You have to find underpriced stocks, and they make money as they move towards the average. But if the entire market is overvalued, you get screwed because the market drops. But if you're a hedge fund, what's the advantage you get if you're a true hedge fund? You can buy the underpriced, you can sell the overpriced, and you make money as they move towards the mean. And even if the market is mispriced, you're okay, right? Because you make money on relative pricing judgments. You can argue that if you're really good at pricing, and you can adopt a long-short strategy, you can take advantage of it. So don't rule out pricing. There are a lot of people who think of pricing as this lesser method of putting a number to a company. Not really. It depends on who you are as an investor and what your strengths are. Now, one of the detours we're going to take is we're going to talk about valuing a company based on the assets it has. Okay? In particular, we're going to look at three versions of this. One is what I'm going to call liquidation valuation. We don't do that very often in a regular class, but sometimes I might come to you with a business and say, look, you know, I'm planning to shut the business down. What do you think I'll make in liquidation? And the difference here is you're going to take each asset you have and try to sell it for the best price you can. You also have what's called sum of the parts valuation. When analysts use this, they make it sound like they've done something dazzling. Sum of the parts valuation, what you do is you break a company down, let's say it's Sony, into 5 or 6 or 8 different businesses. You try to value each business separately, and then you add up the numbers and say, if I add up these numbers, the value that I get for this company is X. It's higher than what it's trading for. The sum of the parts value is greater than the composite value, so the company should break up. Or you can have accounting valuations. We talked about fair value accounting, where essentially accountants are being asked to put numbers on assets that reflect not what you invested in them, which is old-time accounting, but what you think they're worth. But in each of these cases, your job becomes assessing values for individual assets. A lot of people say, why isn't this a different... We talked about three approaches to valuation. You're saying, why isn't this a fourth approach? And here's why I don't think it's a fourth approach. If I ask you to do a sum of the parts valuation of GE, what do you have to do? You have to break GE down to 26 businesses, and you have to put a number on each business, right? And what are the two ways you can put a number on each business? You can do an intrinsic valuation of each business, cash flows, discount rate, or you can do a pricing of each business. You can take each business's EBITDA, multiply it by an EBITDA multiple. In other words, you have to do an intrinsic valuation or a pricing to get to a number. So sum of the parts valuation, again, you're going to come up with this choice. So later in this class, when we get to sum of the parts, you're going to see that it's not a different way of thinking about valuation. It's just a different way of applying existing valuation approaches. So we'll come back and address that, but essentially you can see where we're heading with this. So I'm going to ask you a question which is unfair, absolutely unfair, because the class has just started. You haven't done intrinsic valuation. You haven't done relative valuation. But remember, we talked about priors. We all come in with instincts, with feelings that we have about what we think we're going to find. So this is a question you're going to see in the very last session of this class. But I'm going to ask you the same question now, because I want to see whether your experiences with these approaches changes your view about things. So given what you already think about valuing versus pricing, if I asked you to pick how you would value a company, I want you to go with your gut and say, I'm going to pick intrinsic valuation. I'm going to do pricing, relative valuation. Or maybe you believe markets are efficient and you don't want to tell me that, that's fine. Just, you know, circle it for the moment. And at the end of the class, I'm going to come back and ask this question. Let's see how many of you have changed your minds after your experiences valuing a company or pricing a company. The one approach I haven't talked about is option pricing in the context of valuation. This is what, as I said, falls into the rubric of real options. And I'm a bit of a cynic when it comes to real options. I think they're overused. Right now, it's the hottest concept in corporate finance. People want to apply real options everywhere, and that's extremely dangerous. So one of the things we're going to talk about is when you can apply option pricing in the context of valuation. If you think about what makes an option, here are the three things you need for optionality. First, you need an underlying asset. An option derives its value from something else. You need an underlying asset. You need a contingent payoff, right? That's the nature of options. Something has to happen for the payoff to kick in. And third, options usually have finite lives. So what we're looking for in valuation are other assets that have these characteristics. And I gave you a couple of examples in the last session. Young biotechnology company looks like an option. The underlying asset is the drug that's working its way through the pipeline. What's the contingency? The FDA has to approve it for it to produce cash flows. And the life is whatever the life of the patent. You can see why option pricing can help you in those contexts. And I'm actually going to use payoff diagrams, something we use at the start of option classes to kind of illustrate these examples of options. And we'll talk about applying these options, not to value, listen, I'm going to leave the option applications to the option classes. So if you want to value puts or calls on the CBOE, you want to value warrants, there's a different class for that. I'm not interested in them unless they help me value a business. So these are not the options we're going to spend our time on. What we're really going to be talking about are option-like businesses, and that's what we talked about. Now, we talked about biotechnology companies. We talked about natural resource companies. I'm also going to argue that if you buy shares in a deeply distressed company, let me be specific, deeply distressed in what sense? It's losing money, it's lost money for a long time, and it'll probably continue to lose money, and it has a lot of debt. So why would I even buy shares in this company? At the right price, you should be willing to buy shares in any company. But if you buy shares in a deeply distressed company, I hope you're not buying it for the dividends. I hope you're not buying it for the cash flows, because the only cash flows you're going to get are negative cash flows. You're buying it for the same reasons you buy a deep out of the money option. Right? Most of the time, what's going to happen to your investment in a deeply distressed company? It's going to go to zero. But if it turns around, your 25 cents or 50 cents could become $15. So imagine investing in Continental Airlines in 1992. The shares were trading at $1 per share. Why? Because the company was deeply distressed. 3 years later, the shares were trading at $52 per share. How many investments do you make where you get 5,200% or 52,000% or whatever it works out to as you return? So we're going to actually apply option pricing to value shares in deeply distressed companies, because every other valuation approach you try will not work, because you're not buying cash flows. It's not a relative valuation. You can't price it. Price it based on what? So we're going to talk about using this to actually to extend the reach of valuation. In fact, I'm going to take one final frontier where I think we're going to kind of get to the very edge of valuation. And this goes with the email I sent you about big markets last week, where you see people saying, well, my company's worth a lot because we're in the online advertising market, because we're in the cloud computing market, because we're going to China. We're going to talk about why there might be an optionality there and why you might pay a premium for Twitter because it has 304 million users, allowing you to enter the online advertising market. Not any premium, but we're going to talk about attaching a number to it. So the advantage of real options is that it'll let you attach a number to companies that you otherwise are going to give up on. Discounted cash flow models are not going to work. Relative valuation models are not going to work. It's going to give you a framework for thinking about companies that otherwise are almost untouchable with valuation. The disadvantage is every option pricing model we actually have was designed to value listed options, which are much more short-term, on underlying securities that are actually traded, and we're extending that reach. Let me give you an example. It said a patent can be valued as an option. However, a patent has a 19-year life or a 17-year life. It's not short-term. The underlying asset is that drug that's working its way through the pipeline. It's not traded. So many of the inputs we take for given in option pricing models become much more difficult to estimate, and the assumptions become much more tenuous with option pricing models. So we're going to talk about applying option pricing models, recognizing their limitations, but also recognizing that what you really get out of this is a new perspective on why you might pay a price for a company that other people look at and say, that's a basket case company. So in summary, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of valuation models out there. Yeah. But they can be put into one of these three buckets: intrinsic valuation, relative valuation, or a real options model. And I'm not going to push you saying one is better than the other, because each comes with its uses. And what I would hope you get out of this class is the capacity to not just value companies, but also to price them. It's good to be able to go across that line and see how other people are viewing the company, even if you don't believe in pricing. So that's the big picture. It lays the table for what's coming. Let me get started on the intrinsic valuation. I know we won't get very far, but at least want to get the process underway. So this is actually the first lecture note packet. If you haven't bought it yet, it's at the bookstore, so get to it whenever you can, because starting next session, we're going to be into the first lecture note packet. So the essence of intrinsic valuation, as we've said, is you're trying to value an asset based on its cash flows, its growth, and its risk. Discounted cash flow valuation is not the only way to estimate intrinsic value, but it's the most widely used approach to estimating intrinsic value. So don't use the two interchangeably. Intrinsic value is the generic approach. Discounted cash flow valuation is one way to implement intrinsic value. So let's set the table. Okay? Let's do some valuation 101. If you break it down, as I said, discounted cash flow valuation is simple. It's one equation. Remember last class I said there's not much theory in this class? This is the one page of theory for the whole class. Once we're done with this, we're done with the theory. Because what's the value of an asset? It's the present value. That's that one equation. Value of an asset is the present value of the expected cash flows discounted back at a risk-adjusted rate. There's actually a variant in discounted cash flow valuation that if I get a chance, I'll come back and talk about, where instead of taking the expected cash flows and discounting them back at a risk-adjusted rate, you take the cash flows, the expected cash flows, and you make them what are called certainty equivalent cash flows. What the heck is that? Think about it this way. Let's suppose you have a risky business where you expect to get $100 million next year. It's a risky business, so the $100 million is uncertain. And I give you a trade. I say, would you take $60 million as a guaranteed cash flow instead of the $100 million? Some of you might not. There is some break-even number where you say, hey, $68 million is perfect for me. If you give me a guaranteed $68 million, you can have the expected $100 million. Have you seen Howie Mandel on Deal? This is exactly the show, right? You ever seen it where they open boxes and they, would you take $10,000 or would you take that on? So this is basically, would you take a guaranteed number? If you can give me those certainty equivalent cash flows, then I can discount those back at a risk-free rate. You're saying, I've never seen one of those. It's actually very difficult to implement. But we'll talk about people who use variants of this. Variants would be, for instance, you probably heard that Warren Buffett doesn't risk-adjust his discount rate. But people say, well, Warren Buffett uses a risk-free rate. Why shouldn't I? Be very careful. Because when Warren Buffett looks at earnings and cash flows, he counts on only those earnings that he feels are almost guaranteed. He doesn't do a certainty equivalent in some mathematical sense, but he says, look, you know, you might have 10% growth, but only 2% of that I can count on, so I'm going to count only that 2%. In a sense, he's doing a certainty equivalent cash flow without ever saying those words. So if you can adjust the cash flows to risk, then you don't have to adjust the discount rate. In fact, if you adjusted both, you'd be double counting. So ready? Let's do some valuation 101. I don't know how many of you were in my valuation boot camp. Remember that, right, in the first semester? Any of you, were any of you here that for the boot camp that I ran for MBA? You were in that boot camp? So I'm actually going to do something that I always do in that boot camp, right? Okay, which is about a one-hour session where you're taught just enough valuation to make you dangerous. In your interviews. Basically, this is what people saying, I have an interview, I don't have any valuation experience, not a problem. Thank God you're being interviewed by an investment banker. You don't need that much valuation to get ahead of the game. But that's a different story. So let's do some valuation 101. Okay. I want to pick somebody who's never, ever valued a company. Anybody want to be my guinea pig? Can't be anybody in my corporate finance class, because then you're admitting to something you shouldn't admit to. You've never done a valuation, right? Okay. So here's what I'm going to do. It's an empty envelope. I'm not a magician. I'm going to put $20 into the envelope. And it's really a $20 bill. So How much would you pay for that envelope?
19.
Good. At least you didn't say 20. Most people say 20. First rule in valuation, if you pay $20 for an envelope with $20, what do you get out of the transaction? Envelope. And I stole it. I steal everything. So 19. In fact, my suggestion is start even lower. Start at a dollar. You never know what disease I have. I might not be able to read numbers, for all you know. But if I open this up for bidding, this is too easy an asset. You didn't need this class to price this asset or value it. If the bidding ended, you'd probably end up around $20, right? It's an efficient market. Now, I'm going to add something to the envelope. Can you read that for me? Control. I'm going to put control into this envelope. This $20 plus control. How much did you pay for this envelope now? Start with the 20 because we've already settled that price, but I've now added control to it. 20.1. So you're paying 10 cents for what? You're paying for a 3x5 card with the word control on it. I run this experiment everywhere I go. I once did this for a group of M&A bankers. I won't name the bank. And a guy decides he's going to be clever. He says 24. He's using his rule book, right? Control is worth 20%. You know what I did? I sold him the envelope. That was a really profitable day for me because he paid $4 for a 3x5 card, also stole it. Right? In fact, in the back it says plus 20%. Say congratulations. You kind of get where I'm going next with this. Any people planning to go in M&A here? No, it doesn't matter. You don't want to admit to it after I've said all these mean things. What does it say?
Synergy.
Synergy. Oh, the big word. Okay, I'm going to put that in there. How much did you pay? It's got control and synergy in there. Still only $20, right? 3x5 card with the word synergy. Marketing people get excited. What does it say?
Brand name.
Oh, that's big in marketing, right? I put that in there. Another 3x5 card with the word brand name in it. Nothing added, nothing taken away. I'm not even going to add the last two cards, but I'll tell you what's on them because these are the words that used to work in terms of demanding a premium for something that doesn't deserve a premium. The first, of course, is the word that I absolutely hate that you've heard me use in corporate finance, which is strategic. Strategic to me is the most dangerous word in business. It basically means the numbers don't fly, but I really, really want to do this. Okay? Strategic deal is a really stupid deal. You shouldn't even mean a strategic buyer is a stupid buyer. Another word for a stupid buyer. Or here's the other word that used to work in terms of demanding a premium. What does it say?
China.
For a decade now, that's been the wild card. If nothing else works, you throw in the word China. Oh my God. Billions of people. Add 3 zeros to the revenues. 4 zeros to the income. I call these weapons of mass distraction. You know why? Because they show up after the numbers have been crunched. And what are people wanting you to do? They want you to pay more than the numbers say you should be paying. Saying, it's okay. It's strategic. It's China. If you can put them all together, make it a strategic investment in China, then you get all, you know, really excited about it. But to show you how dangerous this game can be, in the last 2 months, China has gone from being a plus to a minus. All of a sudden, you've got a China exposure. I'm worried about you. I'm not giving you a premium. So that leads me to my first proposition about intrinsic value. I call it the it proposition. If it does not affect the cash flows and it does not affect the risk, it cannot affect value. What's it? You name it. Control. So I'm not saying control doesn't have value. In fact, what's the value of control? That you think you can run a company better than the existing guys, right? So if you tell me that you value control, I have some very specific questions. What are you going to change in this company? And if you tell me what you're going to change, I can show it in the cash flow, show it in the risk, come up with a change in value. I'm not saying synergy is pointless. I'm saying if you have synergy, talk about it. Tell me what's going to change. Higher revenue growth, lower cost. I'll bid in the... So for it to have an effect in value, it's got to affect either the cash flows or the discount rate. Second follow-up proposition, and I call this the duh proposition. I don't get the right amount of contempt on the word duh here because my daughter is perfect at this, especially when she uses it on me. I mean, I have four kids, and with each of them, I noticed this very interesting development. Around the age of two, they thought I knew everything on the face of the earth. They'd ask me questions like, "Dad, what's the meaning of the universe?" And I'd make up an answer. Before Wikipedia, you could do all kinds of stuff and get away with it. And they can't read it to either. So that's the great thing about two-year-olds. Around the age of three, though, they go to bed one day thinking you know everything. The next day, they wake up and you know less than you did the previous day. And it's downhill from there. You get stupider and stupider and stupider and stupider. And around the age of 16, you're now the stupidest person walking the face of the earth. And this was when my daughter got to the age of 16. I was now officially the dumbest, stupidest person on the face of the earth. I'd be at dinner table, topic of conversation would come up where I thought I would have something to contribute. I'd open my mouth, my daughter would sit across the table from me. She'd look at me and say, "Dad, duh." And I'd shut my mouth. For 2 years, I didn't talk. Right? Finally, I seem to be recovering in her intelligence scale. But the duh proposition is related to those emails I get from people saying, "I'm valuing a money-losing company. I expected to lose money forever. What valuation model should I use to value this company?" Which I feel like slapping the person around and saying, "Wake up." Okay? So if your cash flows are going to be negative forever, what the heck are you doing paying for the company? So for your asset to have value, its cash flows will be positive at some point in time. And the final proposition is for those of you who estimate cash flows for your company and end up with a negative number, don't give up yet. If your company has negative cash flows up front, the world hasn't ended. As long as you can get disproportionately large positive cash flows in the future. So if you're valuing Uber, try the valuation of Uber. You're going to see negative cash flows up front. You should, but that's okay. So as we go through this class, all we're going to do is animate this one equation. Come up with better ways of estimating cash flows and better ways of adjusting for risk. And hopefully, we should be able to value any asset out there. So I'll leave you with that. I'll see you a week from today. Is that right? Like the next Monday, we have no class.
Thank you.